From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Put out the welcome mat, toss the keys on the counter, pat your dog or cat, and you are home. So think for a bit about why you moved there in the first place. Was it the neighborhood, the distance to work, that new kitchen or that two-car garage? Or at the end of the day, was it all about affordability? Well, we're taking a look at the factors that go into where we choose to live and why in a special series we're calling Where We Call Home. And first up today, we're going to tackle the lack of affordable housing. Soaring rents and home prices are really changing the face of real estate and home ownership in many places across the country. So this hour on Point, Where We Call Home and how we can make housing affordable again. And you can join us. Is housing your biggest monthly expense? Can you afford to live where you want to? Or have you been priced out? And if home ownership is still so central to the concept of the American dream, what does that mean for your dream? Well, we're going to begin today in Seattle, Washington, where home sale prices, median prices, have doubled in just the past 6 years. The average rent for a one-bedroom apartment in Seattle is $1,650 per month. Mike Rosenberg joins us. He covers real estate for the Seattle Times and reports on that intersection between housing prices and tech companies. Mike, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so first of all, just give us a better sense as to just how far the demand for sort of middle-income housing or housing overall has outstripped what's available in booming Seattle.
Yeah, really, Seattle has seen some of the biggest housing price increases in the country. Just 6 years ago, as you mentioned, it was about $300,000 or so, maybe $350,000 for the single-family house. And now it's about $750,000 for the median single-family house. Rents are over $2,000 a month for two bedrooms. The homelessness crisis has worsened. In Seattle, really everywhere you look, it's people are being priced out, pushed to the peripheries of the region or out of the area altogether.
So this is one of those ironic problems that, in a sense, cities want to have or wish to have because it's being driven by job growth in Seattle. Is that right?
Right. In our case, it's almost too much of a good thing at some point because it gets to a point where prices are so high that people who had been living here can't anymore.
I mean, I'm looking at some of your reporting, and correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the numbers are astonishing, that for every house that goes on the market that's made available in the greater Seattle area, there's, what, more than 1,000 people looking for a home?
Right. Yeah, the population here has boomed, and there's no more room for building single-family homes. So, yeah, the homes to people ratio just keeps getting out of whack, and that's the biggest driver of home price increases.
Aha. So it's a seller's market, which I guess is good for sellers, but the problem is not that enough people are selling, but not enough building going on, really. So talk to us about that. How is it that in Seattle we've had this, I don't want to call it a decoupling, but the pace of economic growth and job growth in Seattle has so far outstripped how many homes or condos or just new units have been built? What's driving that divide?
I think on the supply side, it's, you know, you look at Seattle, we're hemmed in by mountains and water, and there's really no more places to put big tracts of single-family homes unless you're looking at sprawl way out, you know, hours away from here. So really what we've seen is a lot of new density coming up here, and that's almost all big apartment buildings that have gone up here, which means those are only for rent here. So there's been a ton of new rentals coming up, but for anybody looking to actually buy a home, there just hasn't really been that supply here. And then on the demand side, it's really been a story of just incredible economic growth here in Seattle, led by Amazon and other companies from out of the region now, like mainly Facebook and Google, have tried to move in here and have become some of our biggest employers after not even having any presence here whatsoever just a matter of 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about that in a minute because it's a very big part of the story in Seattle here. But, I mean, obviously, Mike, we're based here in Boston. It's kind of like a very similar story here. So I'm quite familiar with some of the drivers here. You're talking about space density issues. What about NIMBYism? What about local regulations making it harder for developers, even if they wanted to put up vast amounts of middle income housing here, which is where the real pinch is? How much of that is an issue in Seattle?
It's definitely an issue here, like just about everywhere. If you look at all of the residential properties in Seattle, about 2/3 of them are zoned only for single-family housing. So a lot of people come here. There's a downtown sort of core area that looks like a city. And then when you get to the northern and southern and tips of the city, it sort of looks like a suburb in a lot of ways because it's just rows of single-family homes where new housing has essentially been banned. And as a result, you've seen about 90% of all the new construction in the city funnel into about 10% of the city's land area. So builders have sort of run out of areas to build there.
Okay, interesting. And then the other big driver that I see in many cities across the country is the sheer cost of construction and financing that investors who, you know, may want to enter the housing market and put some money into a new development, they won't do it unless they can get a certain return, and you get those returns off luxury housing, not middle-income housing. Because I'm also seeing here that in Seattle, there's plenty of luxury housing being built. High-income folks have no problem finding where they want to live.
Right. That's been the biggest problem with all this new housing going up. In theory, it's great, but really, when it opens up, it's only affordable to people who can afford, you know, $2,000 for a one-bedroom. And people who do want to build sort of that just regular housing where you can charge average rates, it's just really hard after you buy the land and go through the construction costs to make that work. And then it's sort of not worth it when you can just build the luxury housing and get people to rent out at higher rates.
Many thousands of dollars a month in certain cases. Okay, so we're going to talk about solutions here in just a minute and certain things that are happening in Seattle. But really, Mike, I want to just explore with you, how much has this changed what it means to live a middle-class life in Seattle? So let me just play some tape here. This is former Washington State Governor Christine Gregoire. She now leads a group called Challenge Seattle. It's an organization made up of executives from top local companies that really aim to address the housing issues that have an impact on Seattle. She talked to Bloomberg last month about an affordable housing crisis in the city.
Of the 100 responders from one of our local utilities that does first response in case of loss of electricity and so on, 3 live within close proximity to where they actually work. The rest are over 90 minutes away. Everybody is impacted when that happens. So it's economic impact, it's social impact, it's quality of life impact, it's health, it's safety, it's an impact in every way.
That's Christine Gregoire, the former governor of the state of Washington. I mean, Mike, isn't this really kind of one of the emerging major problems here? And that is, for the very people whose work goes into supporting the civic infrastructure of major American cities, they can't afford to live in the very places they serve. I mean, how much is that changing Seattle?
It's probably the number one issue in the city right now. I mean, you had for a long time people on the lower income end of the spectrum being priced out, and now it's people in the middle class simply have zero chance of ever being able to afford a house here, and just keeping up with the rents is hard enough as it is. So you see people moving further out. Teachers, firefighters, police officers, even one of the local police chiefs can't afford to live in his own town. And people just sort of look at their future in Seattle and look at the prices keep going up and their income's not keeping pace if they're not working at a high-level job, and sort of see what exactly is my future here. And that changes the culture of Seattle, which has always sort of been this middle-class town.
I mean, look, in the most cynical amongst us might say, at what point in time does it reach a state where it looks like it's kind of like a feudal system here. We've got the very, very rich and very low income people. And there's like no middle in a city like Seattle. It could sound potentially feudal.
Yeah, man, it's not that wild to think about. I mean, if you look at places like San Francisco, it's already happened. So I think a lot of people are looking at Also, our nearby friends in Canada and Vancouver are going through the same thing with their home prices. So there's a lot of sort of examples out there to look at and say this is our future if we don't do something right now.
Okay. So the question is what to do. And we'll talk about what the city of Seattle proposed and then got shot down by Amazon. But enter Microsoft here, because in January, Microsoft pledged $500 million, $500 million, to address homelessness and affordable housing in the Puget Sound region. Microsoft President Brad Smith spoke to NPR member station KUOW about whether he thought Microsoft actually deserves some of the blame for the housing crisis.
In some ways, people would look at this region and say this is a high-class problem to have. You know, all of this job growth, a lot of great jobs have been added here. But it just goes to show that when you create jobs, you got to create more housing for people to live in. And you can debate who's responsible for that. The truth is, we need to go solve this, and it's going to take all of us.
That's Microsoft President Brad Smith here. So, Mike Rosenberg, tell us, what is it that Microsoft is pledging to do with this $500 million?
Well, the first chunk is $25 million in grants for homelessness services around here, and that's been key focus for a lot of people here as the homelessness crisis has worsened. And the other $475 million are going to be handed out in the form of loans for developers. So about half of that is going to just sort of traditional low-income housing that is getting built a little bit here and there in the city. And the other half is going towards what we talked about earlier in terms of middle-income housing, and this is the sort of market rate apartments that really just aren't getting built because you don't get any sort of government subsidies or help, but it's also doesn't make sense to build from a developer's perspective because you could just build the the luxury housing. So it's sort of these projects that people really want that could be affordable to middle class people that people just aren't seeing come online right now.
Well, Mike Rosenberg, reporter covering housing and real estate for the Seattle Times, stand by here. This is part one of our special series, Where We Call Home, where we're talking about the affordable housing crisis, call it workforce housing, call it middle income housing, but the real crunch in booming cities across America when it comes to keeping middle class families in the cities while they grow. We want to know if this is something that's hitting you. Is it harder to stay in the place where you want to live? We'll be back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about where we call home. It's part one of our special series about housing and where we call home in America. And today we're focusing on the crunch when it comes to middle class housing or workforce housing, especially in booming cities across America. And I'm joined today by Mike Rosenberg. He's a reporter covering housing and real estate for the Seattle Times. And Seattle is facing this problem head on as that city continues to grow. We want to hear from you about whether affordability has become a major question for you or a determining factor for you in where you call home. And by the way, Mike, I should just note here that we actually put out this online survey to On Point listeners about affordable housing issues in their lives. And, you know, it's a survey. It's not a scientific poll by any stretch of the imagination. But we got some interesting responses here. Out of some roughly 650 people who responded to the question, I worry about my cost of living, more than half of folks said yes, they sometimes do, 51.3%. 37.6% of folks said they frequently worry about their cost of living. And a lucky 11% said nope, they never have to worry about it. So good for those lucky 11. Hopefully we want to make it more than that. Mike, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation Molly Fitzpatrick. She joins us from Denver. She's managing director of the Root Policy and Root Policy Research, a national community housing and research firm. So Molly Fitzpatrick, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so you heard Mike Rosenberg walk us through the challenges that the city of Seattle is facing right now. Give us a more national picture here. How common is this combination in growing cities of more and more good jobs but less and less affordable housing?
Sure. And we really are seeing that in a national way, and that nationwide over the past 10, 15 years, affordability has really become a concern because housing costs are rising faster than incomes. It's sort of that straightforward. But those challenges are not equally distributed. We see more acute challenges for renters because renter incomes have largely stayed flat, whereas rents have gone up by about 50% since 2000. That's nationwide. But those challenges are also not equally distributed geographically. And so we're really seeing a lot of cities like Seattle, where there's just booming job markets and a lot of economic growth, those cities in particular are not able to keep up with that economic growth from a housing growth perspective. There are lots of cities across the country where there still is relatively affordable middle market, sort of that middle class housing, but those are not in the markets where we're seeing so much of the population and economic growth. And so there's really this sort of geographic disparity that's really making this an acute issue for a lot of cities, particularly California, really on both coasts, as well as some cities in the middle of the country. You know, Denver's had major housing price growth, so has the city of Austin, city of Nashville. There's a handful of even sort of middle country cities that are really seeing a lot of these pressures.
Okay. Well, so you heard Mike, though, say that in the past decade or so, they've seen a doubling of the median house price in Seattle for all – because of all the reasons we've been talking about here. So things have been changing very, very quickly. I'm wondering, is there a silver lining here? And that is that eventually housing stock will catch up with demand. And so perhaps we're just in the – we're in the painful phase now of a city that's got admirable economic growth.
Sure. And this, the development of housing always lags a little bit behind demand. Jobs and people move faster than buildings. And so we see always a little bit of a lag. But we're seeing a really acute lag, I would say, right now. I mean, the rate of housing growth nationwide has significantly slowed in the past 20 to 25 years. I mean, we hardly developed any housing as a country, or at least hardly had net positive housing gains between 2011 and 2013. So that was in the wake of the recession.
Right.
But we're starting to see some increases. And so in that sense, there is some silver lining. The single family development is up a little bit, but it's still pretty low by historical norms. And I would say that we've really kind of created this problem in some cities by having a lot of land use regulation that is limiting what we can build and how fast we can build it. And so while there is some of this is just market forces and market lag, there are some other things that we've kind of put in place as communities that make it more difficult for us to catch up.
Okay. So Mike Rosenberg, let me turn back to you here for just a second. So about those things that we've put in place as communities, we touched on a couple of them in the previous segment here, but is Seattle working to sort of relax those regulations or those zoning restrictions, for example, that might make building more housing more challenging than the city needs it to be right now?
Yeah, I think people here in Seattle will tell you they were a little late to the game with that, but they're starting to do it. They have changed zoning in a few neighborhoods to allow for taller buildings. And if you go around Seattle, you can really easily see which neighborhoods those are because we lead the country in the number of cranes right now, and they're sort of concentrated in those neighborhoods. And there's another effort going on right now to do more of a broader citywide upzone where they would change the rules to rezone about 6% of the city's single-family zoning to allow for other types of housing. And then in other neighborhoods, you'd see just taller buildings allowed that aren't allowed right now.
Okay. So Molly Fitzpatrick, I want to turn back to something that I talked about with Mike a couple of minutes ago. And that is, in some of these cities, Seattle and the Bay Area in particular, the very tech companies that have brought all of these high paying jobs and are a force in the housing crunch there are trying to step in with some solutions, right? We talked about Microsoft giving $500 million or planning to give out $500 million to support housing efforts in Seattle. Something very similar is happening in the Bay Area. And in January, a coalition led by the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, that is, yes, the initiative, Mark Zuckerberg's initiative from the Facebook CEO, they announced that they would seek to increase affordable housing in the Bay Area. So here's Priscilla Chan outlining the goals of the coalition in a promotional video.
The Partnership for the Bay's Future is a public-private partnership, and it's an incredible opportunity to try to build a solution together to protect the rights of 200,000 families and individuals for whom their access to housing may be compromised over the next 5 years. On the future-facing side, we need to be able to preserve and produce 8,000 more units over the next 5 to 10 years.
It's Priscilla Chan of the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative talking about many hundreds of millions of dollars that they're trying to put forward to deal with affordable housing in the Bay Area. Molly Fitzpatrick, here's my question to you about that. Laudable, for sure. Also laudable, what Microsoft is doing. But it seems as if these are solutions that rely on the largesse and whims of corporations that are part of the problem here. And that's no sort of shift in policy or basic structure or framework to make housing easier and more and faster to build. I mean, the word feudal keeps coming up in my mind. How are we going to break out of this system where we look to corporations to help solve problems when really what we need are structural changes?
Sure. And I totally agree. And I think that this is one solution in a mix of a lot of potential solutions. And there's not one thing that's going to fix the housing crisis. And I think that really employers only tend to get involved when they are very large employers and when the problem becomes really, really bad. So the only other places kind of outside of Silicon Valley that we see that happening is actually even in sort of really small resort type communities where you've got one major employer like a ski town, then the ski mountain will fund some employer-sponsored housing. But the reality is that the problem got a lot further down the road. That is not necessarily the thing that will fix it. I mean, absolutely injecting capital into the problem and helping increase development and helping create housing trust funds when you can do that through employers or even having linkage fees between what employers are developing or commercial space development and linking that to a housing fund, paying into housing fund when you also develop commercial space. There's a lot of ways to try and capture and balance that housing and jobs dynamic. But I agree that that's not the fundamental solution isn't just to say, oh, employers should just give us more money and build the housing themselves.
All right. Well, let's go to the callers. Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Mark, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My point is that if you leave it to market forces to create affordable housing, then I think it's a losing proposition. The only way that we can get that kind of development is by the city itself becoming either a developer, buying up property, holding in reserve, and developing it themselves, or creating land trusts that then allow others to build at a lower price and thereby provide the kind of affordable housing that the city needs. It needs its policemen. It needs its teachers. It needs people of moderate means to be able to live in accessible places.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you for your call. Mike Rosenberg, let me turn back to you. Intriguing idea that Mark had about doing things that allows the city to become a kind of developer. Anything like that going on in Seattle?
I think you see a little bit of it. I mean, every few years, the voters here will pass a bond, and you know, I think the most recent one was $500 million to build this sort of affordable housing. The issue is it's just a function of housing. It's just so unbelievably expensive to build, and the number of units is so high that, you know, whether you're talking about a bond from the city or the money Microsoft is giving, any of these individual efforts wind up sort of being a drop in the bucket relative to the overall need. And you've seen some very small amount of community land trusts also where you would have people in the community sort of get together and oversee a project to ensure that it remains affordable. That's something we're starting to see a little bit more of, but it's part of it is just all these solutions sort of start to add up together because there's really not one magic bullet that goes in and can just sort of solve this issue.
Yeah, let me just ask you quickly though, Mike, because you reported on the fact that there have been previous local efforts in Seattle to inject a lot of cash into the system to maybe encourage developers to build middle-income housing, right? Like a couple of years ago, there were two companies that teamed up on a $500 million fund, the same exact amount that Microsoft is giving now to build middle-income housing. And these two companies hoped that others would follow suit, but they have not seen a single other major developer go after middle-income projects in Seattle.
Right. And it's so hard. To be able to do that, you need to find a landowner who's either civically conscious or has some thing they want to include in development. Like, you know, we're into the arts, so if you can include an art gallery in your project, you know, we'll give you the land for a discount. And then you have to go through and sort of strip the building down of any sort of frills, which means, you know, in Seattle, no parking, no sort of amenities. And then you need to be able to market this out to banks and say, you know, we project a much smaller return than these luxury developers are anticipating. So can you give us some money anyway? And in a lot of cases, the answer to that is no. So the problem is these developers, even if you want to do that, it really takes somebody who is willing to sort of sift through all of this and go through and be willing to stick to it and do these projects really slowly.
Mm. Well, let's go to Janine, who's calling from Columbia, Missouri. Janine, you're on the air.
Hi, so good to be here.
Great to have you, Janine. Go ahead.
So I live in Columbia, Missouri, and I'm a student at the University of Missouri. And I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about affordable student housing. We've had in the past about 5 years just an explosion of downtown high-rises, which are very expensive for students and include fitness centers and tanning salons and juice bars. And then my second part is just a suggestion. What if the developers were building these luxury homes, luxury apartments, and then a price cap was initiated some years later, say 10 years or 20 years?
On the sale, on the future sale of that apartment, or the rent?
On the future rent.
So you're talking about rent control?
Right, after a time. Like, they could charge the premium, and then after agreed upon number of years, reduce the price.
Okay, Janine, actually, it's an interesting idea. Molly Fitzpatrick, let me turn back to you on that. Maybe just entirely different models of thinking, of allowing developers to make their sort of immediate term gains, but once all that is taken care of, regulate prices in the future. And your thoughts on that?
Sure. It can get kind of complicated, and it's a great idea, I think, to figure out how can we set up solutions that do allow developers to make money. We're not trying to say you shouldn't make any money on developing housing, right? And so I think the key there is to find some trigger that gives developers an incentive and then allows you to extract something from them in return. So generally that's structured through incentives. For example, you may be as a developer by right allowed to develop a five-story building on a parcel and you'd make X amount of dollars from that. We as a community could say, or as a city could say, all right, we'll give you three extra stories on that building so you can make a lot more money, but you have to price control or deed restrict some of those units or a portion of those units. So typically that works best if there's kind of a carrot involved. So if you can allow the developer some flexibility and then in return you ask for affordability.
So Molly, can I just circle back to something that our earlier caller Mark asked about, and I wanted to get your view on this because, you know, Mark made the assertion that you just simply cannot rely on the free market to find the right set of solutions on this because the drivers are all maybe they're not the right ones that would help us with the middle income housing problem.
Right.
You know, he talked about cities themselves becoming developers or forming more land trusts. I mean, these are actually not new ideas. Historically, I mean, especially internationally, these are some of the ideas that other countries and cities have used. Are they viable in the United States?
Yeah, they absolutely are viable. And we see a lot of communities doing that. There's a lot of cities that do land bank or that contribute to land trusts, land trust housing. Those are often run as nonprofits but have city dollars that flow on or city land donations that help make those possible. And I think he brings up a really good point that the free market isn't going to solve this problem. But I would also say that the free market isn't necessarily the only contributor to the problem. And so we tend to think of housing as this completely free market. People build stuff. If you you want it, you buy it. It's very clear economically. But the reality is that we have a lot of structures in place that limit how free that market really is. We have zoning codes. We have development process. We have fees. We have taxes. We have all of these things that really create what the housing market is, or at least create the bounds for our housing market. And so I think there's also a lot of policy solutions that aren't necessarily direct subsidies for housing development, but that can be policy tools to help free up the market to actually meet demand. And while there certainly are some challenges to that, land costs, construction costs for one, and even available land, as we talked about in Seattle, but there are some other things that we can do to help free up the market.
Well, Molly Fitzpatrick and Mike Rosenberg, hang on here for just a minute, because we are talking about where we call home, and specifically, this is our special series, and today we're talking about the crunch in terms of middle income or workforce housing in some of the fastest growing cities in America. We want to hear from you. Is affordability, in terms of the roof over your head, a major issue in your life? We'll be back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are bringing you the first part in our special series called Where We Call Home. And we're talking about the affordability crisis when it comes to middle-income housing in some of America's fastest-growing cities. We got some voicemails from listeners who talked to us about the challenges they have in finding affordable housing. And so just listen to Shafi Katongale, an On Point listener who lives in Lowell, Massachusetts. He left us this voicemail about his struggle to find housing he can afford.
I'm the only one working in the family. My wife is not working, and we're expecting a baby in April. But it scares me because I have to sign another lease in April. But I feel I cannot afford the place that I'm at. I got there in 2015. It was quite affordable, but it's gone up really, really fast. Every year it's like $100. You find something that is called affordable housing, still it's way out of control.
That's On Point listener Shafi Katongale leaving us a voice message about his concerns about affordable housing. And we had this survey that we put out. And yes, caveat, not a scientific poll, but a survey of On Point listeners online. And we asked them questions such as, has affordability had an impact on where you want to live? And out of about 650 responses, almost 70% of people said, yes, it has had an impact on where they want to live. Well, we're joined today by Mike Rosenberg, a reporter covering housing for the Seattle Times. Molly Fitzpatrick is also with us. She's managing director at Root Policy Research, a national community housing and research firm. And let me bring into the conversation now Chris Folio, joining us from Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Chris is founder and CEO of Community Investment Strategies, a low and moderate income housing development firm. Also former executive director of the New Jersey Housing and Mortgage Finance Agency, where she was credited with creating the housing policy for the state of New Jersey. Chris Folio, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so first of all, you've got a lot of experience in housing in New Jersey. Can you point to a solution or an experiment regarding increasing the amount of middle-income housing that you've seen that works?
Well, I was listening earlier, and New Jersey was pretty much one of the first states to go out with a requirement that each of our municipalities has an obligation to produce affordable housing. It's known as the Fair Housing Act, and basically it's a very strong policy towards inclusionary housing, which a percentage of any developer's zoning authority must be set aside for affordable. Normally, 20% of the project would have to be in an affordable category. I think the issue, as you've been pointing to, is that a lot of these programs have done a good job in addressing people earning less than 50% of median income, but we've all continued to struggle in meeting that 60, 80, 120% of median income, which is really your working class type of housing.
Right. And so what do we do to better support those Americans and families? Because, you know, the other thing that we're seeing is that as some wages do rise. They rise enough to knock people out of getting subsidies or assistance from the government, but they don't rise enough to put them into a band of income where they can afford the housing.
Right. We see this consistently with our affordable housing projects that we build. I will give kudos to HUD, who has recognized that there was a problem with their low-income housing tax credit program, which really drives the rental market across the nation. They did last year move the incomes to 80% of median, which starts to at least address some of the people that have been left out of the programs. But to give you an example of seniors that apply for affordable housing, it's not unusual in New Jersey for someone to have a pension of $50,000 a year, and they will be over income even at the 80% of median. But they really don't have enough money to afford the units that Mike was talking about, where, you know, in New Jersey, the good rental markets are $2,000 to $2,400 a month for a one-bedroom.
Mm. Well, Mike Rosenberg, what do you hear in what Chris Folio is saying about what they've done in New Jersey?
Yeah, it's something that Seattle has been a little behind on. They're trying to catch up a little bit now. There's a policy going through that they're trying to get a certain number of units in each new apartment that have to be affordable, or, you know, you set aside certain units that are affordable, or you pay into a fund that the city can then use to build affordable housing projects. And that's something that sort of making its way through now and has been going on in other West Coast cities. And there's a question of, you know, sort of how much affordable housing should you include in the project? Because, you know, in theory, you want to include as much as possible, but the more you include, the less incentive there is for developers to build at all. So they're sort of trying to find that magic number right now.
Right. So, Molly Fitzpatrick, let me turn back to you here for a second, because Deirdre Hayes, an On Point listener, sent us this question. It's a fundamental one, but an important one to understand. Deirdre says, are housing prices going through the roof, or have wages remained largely stagnant for decades?
Yeah, and that's a great question, and one that economists have certainly looked at, labor economists as well as housing economists. And I think the answer is it depends on the person. So we've seen renter wages largely stagnant. I mean, basically no real income growth, that is income not really keeping up with inflation, since about 2000. And so particularly for renters and lower income segments across the country, wages really have not grown, whereas housing prices have clearly increased, both rental and ownership prices. And so certainly we're seeing some of this as an income issue, but also some of it as a housing price issue. So our recovery from the recession has not been even across income levels. And so we've seen really the lower income sort of wage earners not having as much recovery as higher income wage earners. And so we're seeing kind of both is an issue, that we've got largely stagnant wages in some sectors, but also increasing housing prices across the board.
Okay. And so back to one other thing you said a little earlier in the show. You said that post the recession, there was a dip in housing starts, right?
Right.
Do you see that turning around, though, nationwide? We're now in 2019.
Mm-hmm. And it has – our housing starts have certainly increased over the past 4 years probably. They're really starting to see an uptick in those, but it's still relatively low by historic standards as a percent of the overall housing stock in the country. So we're hoping that that continues to increase and that helps to catch us up, but we haven't seen that back up to the point where we'd like to see it.
Right. Well, we have a comment here on Facebook. Nancy Hartgold says, my dream is to someday have a home with a yard. I recently turned 50 and it isn't going to happen anytime soon. Nancy left South Florida because she couldn't afford a home, now in Maryland, and we won't be able to afford a home either. Places where there are plentiful jobs just don't have affordable homes. Let's go to Andrew, who's calling from Syracuse, New York. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hello. My comment is that as a part of the younger generation, it is very difficult to move into homes. I currently live in a renting situation, and paying that rent and then having the upfront cost of moving into a home is very difficult, especially being $50,000 to $60,000 in debt from college loans.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you so much for your call. Chris Folio, let me turn back to you on that, because this is definitely an issue for a lot of millennials and younger Americans as well, that at one time in the past where ostensibly they would have been able to save for a future down payment, a lot of folks say that that's even out of reach because of their other financial burdens as well. How much is that setting them back?
I think it's actually changing the market because they're just not able to be in a home ownership kind of situation. So what's actually happening in New Jersey is we have seen high density for sale housing really come to a halt. I would guess that we're seeing in the better markets, 80% of the building permits are for rental housing. I think that the market is actually identifying that this is a class of housing that's no longer affordable, and therefore developers are not building it.
Now, you know, I know a lot of people, Chris, might say in the long run they didn't necessarily want to be homeowners, so perhaps being a renter for a longer period of time is totally fine with them. But how much do you think it matters that home ownership is maybe out of reach for a lot of people for whom it once wasn't? I mean, I started out this hour by saying it's like it was a fundamental aspect of the American dream for so long. How much is that basic dream changing, and does that matter?
Well, I think you're right. I think the basic dream is changing. And I know when I graduated from college, the first thing you wanted to do was to start saving, and you had this goal of home ownership. I do believe that millennials did see the downturn in the real estate market. Many people have lived through a loss of equity, and so they're very frightened. It may not be the best investment for them. So I believe in, you know, the current situation, society is really changing in terms of, do I put roots down? Do I make a commitment to community? Do I invest a lot of time, energy, and money in a place? And I think communities will really suffer when we start to think of ourselves as transient and not laying
right.
roots.
And Molly Fitzpatrick, so yes, there's the issue of how do we get people to feel rooted in their communities if they're not owning in those communities. But also historically in America, that first house has been the rung of the ladder that you grab onto for intergenerational wealth building, right? And so isn't that also a major problem here when we're looking into the future regarding middle-class Americans? We already know that that Latino and African Americans have relatively much smaller net wealth than white Americans. That gap is certainly going to be able to grow as well if people can't get on that bottom rung of home ownership.
Absolutely. And I think even more than the bottom rung, I mean, home equity is the primary source of wealth for middle-income families
right.
nationwide. And so when we see fewer families in accessing that type of potential wealth, then absolutely that creates potentially a problem, right? It makes it much more difficult to build wealth. And I think you're absolutely right in that it contributes to disparate rates of return on that wealth. And we've seen really a wide racial wealth gap in America, and that lower home ownership rates could exacerbate that gap. And we as a country also tend to incentivize through tax deductions being a homeowner. I mean, mm-hmm. our biggest housing subsidy, if you can call it that, is the mortgage interest tax deduction. And so we've really structured the country to say, home ownership is good, and this is how you can build wealth and save on your taxes. And so to take that away, we either need to rethink how we can facilitate wealth building in communities. If it's not going to be home ownership, then we need to think about what are other ways to do that and how can we help incentivize that.
Let's see if I can sneak in a couple of callers before we run out of time. Let's go to Maya, who's calling from San Francisco. Maya, you're on the air.
Hi. I work for a advocacy nonprofit that advocates for affordable housing, the Council of Community Housing Organizations, and our city is seeing an astonishing loss of affordable housing. For every two units of affordable housing built, we lose one to either, you know, Ellis Act evictions, owner move-ins, condo conversions, and demolitions. So we are focusing on combating this affordability crisis with land banking solutions uh-huh. like our small sites program and the Community Opportunity to Purchase Act. And I think preserving affordable housing should also be a key strategy
right.
for cities.
Well, yes. Maya, thank you so much for your call. So not just building more, but preserving what's already there. Interesting view from San Francisco, one of the epicenters of this problem. Let's go to John, who's calling from Detroit. John, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. So I'll keep it brief. I've been involved in community development for 30 years. We built 70 units of home ownership program type of thing, won a low-income housing tax credit. And unfortunately, they came online just before the great crisis, the housing crisis, so it was not as successful as it could have been. But I want to just put out there that I haven't heard any. I've heard things about, oh, well, there's too much regulation, but I don't think there's enough regulation. I think that since all things in the United States affect all people, that where we choose to build some of these places that are constantly having to be rebuilt because of major storms, and just the sprawl that costs everybody money, everybody. We have to build new hospitals, new school systems, new police forces, and the bottom line is that we haven't grown. The incomes haven't grown, nor have the populations.
Right.
We just have more of everything that we have to pay for.
Well, John, thank you so much for your call. Chris Folio, let me get your response to what John said. He wants more regulation to help shape the housing market to help folks.
Well, I can tell you in New Jersey, we really do have very strong land development policy, some of the strongest in the country. And I think that they've done a good job of reducing sprawl, concentrating through policy. So I think John's right. You can drive development. So, for example, in certain areas of the state, you can get a pilot, payment in lieu of taxes, which really helps you on the economic side of making your numbers work from a developer perspective. You can get higher densities if you are not impacting stormwater or wetlands and the like. So I do believe forward-thinking regulations can really help to define good high-density housing and combat sprawl.
Well, Mike Rosenberg, we've just got a couple seconds left here to go. Do you think Seattle is moving towards finding the right set of solutions for the city, or is it going to be a lot harder?
I think it's going to be really hard. I think some of the things that the city has been doing and that the private market has been doing are, you know, it's helping. Rents have stopped skyrocketing, for instance, the way they were earlier in the decade. But I think, you know, we're never going to go back to being a truly affordable city the way the sort of old Seattle was. And it's at this point, it's sort of a matter of stopping things from getting worse or maybe helping to make sure things get a little bit better for affordability, which is just sort of the natural state of things here with the economy being so booming.
Well, Mike Rosenberg, reporter covering housing for the Seattle Times, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Molly Fitzpatrick, Managing Director at Root Policy Research and National Community Housing and Research Firm. Molly, it was great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Chris Folio, founder and CEO of Community Investment Strategies, a low and moderate income housing development firm in New Jersey. Real pleasure to have you, Chris. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And folks, this was just part one in our special series, Where We Call Home. In part two next week, we'll be looking at cities and states that are offering cash to entice would-be residents. The catch is that you have to be employed full-time somewhere else. So cities and states saying, hey, move here, but work from home for someone else, please. That's next week on our special series, Where We Call Home. Go to onpointradio.org for more information on this series and to let us know what you think, as always. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.